I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory.
You know, I did my PhD at Berkeley, which is renowned as supposedly the maybe the most liberal university in America. And yet, when people there were faced with this situation where there was abuse in their own community, they fell back on the same patterns of behavior that we've seen so many times in the Catholic Church, in Hollywood, in the military, in sports, in so many different institutions that are closed, hierarchical, and have some kind of claim of specialness. You know, they are bound by these threads of deference and trust. And when someone within the community steps out, kind of violates the social compact and says that someone misused their power, there's a rip in this web, then everyone within that system, I think, has a vested interest in sweeping it under the rug, in not listening, in believing a distorted narrative that doesn't require them to do anything or change their views, in forgetting. Hello, my name is Joy Neumeier. I'm a journalist and historian of Russia and Eastern Europe, currently based in Warsaw. And I am the author of the book, A Survivor's Education, Women, Violence, and the Stories We Don't Tell.
Joy, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thank you very much.
So I wanted to start with a powerful scene from your book where you decide to tell this story. And this is not an easy story to tell. And again, I've been doing this podcast for a few years now, and it's been the kind of history that you were educated to write about, the history of people who are no longer with us. And you're telling your story, and it's not only a story about people who are still there. It's your own story, and it's a painful story. It's not an easy story to tell. And you have a moment in time where you're on a train in Siberia and you decide that you need to tell it. Could you paint a picture of that moment, of that scene, and that decision?
I was traveling by train through Siberia in the summer of 2018. And at the time, I was engaged in a seemingly endless Title IX investigation to get to the bottom of what happened during an abusive relationship I'd had with another graduate student, which I fortunately escaped. And I was also just a normal PhD student who was focused on the history of Russia and the Soviet Union. And so I was there trying to gather material from archives and resume my day job of studying the lives of other people in the past. At the same time, this investigator back in Berkeley, where I was doing my PhD, was going through my personal communications and trying to build some kind of truthful account of what had happened to me. It was kind of the wee dawn hours, and I was having trouble sleeping. And suddenly this vision kind of awoke me from my stupor. I remembered my ex-boyfriend dragging me out of bed by the neck when I had been asleep in the middle of the night. And I was so unnerved by the fundamental wrongness of this situation. This face of this person I loved and trusted in front of me, suddenly incandescent with rage, waking me from sleep at a moment when I completely hadn't expected it, with his hand wrapped around my neck. And it reminded me of a solar eclipse. This feeling, quite literally, that there's darkness at noon, time is out of joint, something is deeply wrong with the situation. And it reminded me of a character who I had encountered in my historical teaching and research named Nikolai Bukharin, who was a top official and intellectual in the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s. He had been very close with Lenin and Stalin, who, of course, became the supreme leader. And when the terror began in the mid-1930s, Stalin began to play this cat-and-mouse game with Bukharin, where he would constantly accuse him of having committed various wrongs against the party, against Lenin, him personally. And Bukharin would be put in this position of perpetually apologizing and making excuses for himself, even though he was the one being victimized. And it reminded me so much of how I felt over the course of that entire relationship. And on that night in particular, when I was woken from sleep, I was constantly bending over backwards to placate and apologize for all of these imaginary crimes that I had supposedly committed against this man. And as I sorted through this very surreal mixture of impressions from the 1930s and from my own life only a couple of years ago, I pulled out my laptop and started writing. And the couple of paragraphs that I put down registering these impressions and these uncanny connections between past and present became the basis for the essay that ultimately turned into this book.
But it's fascinating. This difficult lived experience, when for whatever reason it gets triggered, the memory of that gets triggered when you're on that train and you're trying to process this, and you're processing this through your training and your research as a historian working on the Russian past, and you're recalling this particular individual among the Soviet elite who has a tragic end to his own story. And that's part of how you're trying to make sense of this. I mean, there's a natural filtering. This is not really part of a figuring out how to put together a narrative for your book. This is actually how you were trying to figure it out yourself.
Yes, exactly. When you study history at any time, but especially when you do a PhD, you're immersed in this very hothouse environment where the past constantly becomes your frame of reference for the present in a way that's so subtle. It just seeps into your life in these ways that you don't even realize or particularly notice. But when I began dating this PhD student who was also in my program and also partially studying Europe and Eastern Europe, we were very conscious of the past as it suffused our interpersonal present. And when we started dating, we were so happy and excited that we compared it to the euphoria of the Russian Revolution, which might sound ridiculous to the the non-PhD student person, but to us, it was totally natural. And unfortunately, this initial euphoria and sense of utopia between the two of us ended up following the arc of the Russian Revolution, which from this initial heady beginning, of course, turns to paranoia, suspicion, and terror of the kind that you saw in the relationship between Bukharin and Stalin, and also on a massive scale. So again, I was quite conscious of this at the time, because oddly enough, as all this was happening, I was a TA for a Soviet history class. So I was discussing Stalinism with my students at the same time as I was sorting through all of these very disorienting and often terrifying dynamics in my personal life. So I really looked to the stories of other people in the past to help me make sense of what was happening to me now. And as you mentioned, Buhadin's story, for example, had a very tragic ending. All of his attempts at apologizing and self-deprecation and trying to distort his perception of reality to bring it closer to Comrade Stalin's, they failed. He was shot anyway. He was not able to save himself from this individual who wanted to dominate him. And among many other stories that I was thinking about at the time, which we might talk some about later, this is one of the things, one of the seeds that planted in my brain that told me, you need to get out of this. You could share the fate that Buhadin did.
And putting this down on paper, I mean, you're going through a whole process first. I mean, you decide to go through a process through the university to seek recourse, but telling your story and writing it down is a whole nother matter. And it's a way of structuring that past, making sense of it. And history is one lens that you look through. But reading that first part of your book, and your book is divided up into three sections, the first part really tells the story of that relationship. Like you said, it was a kind of a fantasy relationship. You're starting graduate school and there are all kinds of endless possibilities and you're excited to be there. And it's this incredible opportunity and you make this special friendship. And as I'm reading this, I'm kind of, it's like a horror story. You kind of know, okay, this is heading towards someplace dark. and you're kind of dreading as you're reading what's going to happen next. But throughout that first section, I kind of felt like you were trying to remember. You're working through that past, but it's a kind of a memory process where you're looking for clues and hints and pieces of evidence of why, you know, didn't you see this coming? How did you miss this? And I felt like, boy, Joy's really coming down hard on herself. She's really being very critical of herself for not seeing this. I don't know whether this was me reading this in my own way or is that an accurate reflection of that first part of the book?
That's such an interesting question. I think one of the fundamental moral dilemmas that historians grapple with is hindsight. Why didn't we see something coming? Whether that's the rise of a dictator in the past or in more recent days, there's this strange phenomenon in human experience where something catastrophic seems impossible to imagine more often than not before it happens. You know, we always think, it'll be okay. You know, that guy's not gonna, he won't really do the things he says he will, whatever the case may be. And then after it happens, it suddenly is recast as having been inevitable, unavoidable. There were all these long-term and short-term dynamics that were just leading up to this particular point. So if you study history, you're always wrestling with this weird psychological phenomenon. And I think in this case, I don't blame myself, or I don't think I was angry at myself for not having perceived what would happen earlier, because part of the process of writing this book entailed sorting back through thousands of text messages, emails, voice notes, all kinds of things that this person and I exchanged over the course of several years. Because as you alluded to, we were very close friends even before we started dating, and we were in constant contact. And I myself was surprised looking back at how close, how happy we seemed to be. I thought I knew him so well. And of course, on second, third, fourth look, you start to identify little things that could have been a red flag at the time. But you know, like anyone looking at the past and trying to understand something terrible, I couldn't see it until it happened, at which point everything kind of snapped into focus. And even when the way he acted towards me started to change quite rapidly once we began dating, even after he became physically violent towards me over and over and over again, I still didn't really want to see it. The cognitive dissonance is too strong. You want to live in a world where you can trust the people that you like, that you think you know. And this person always had such an incredible gift, really, for storytelling in a way where he could just flip anything that happened around to make himself the victim and me the perpetrator in one way or another. And he would do this in all sorts of ways. He came from a very underprivileged background and is a person of color. So he would play on various aspects of basically white middle-class liberal guilt that I had. He would get into all sorts of narratives about how I had been with too many men before him, and I had been basically a slut, and I hadn't taken good enough care of him when he was having these problems with depression. Which, of course, I had spent a lot of time helping tend to his mental health back when we were friends. But just over and over, everything you could imagine, any kind of story to twist the situation and keep me from seeing what was happening to me, what I was physically experiencing in my body. And one of the things I wanted to capture in the book is how you can only allow yourself to try to see all those red flags, the things you missed, all of the dark aspects of what this person did to you after you leave, once you're safe. And you can start rewriting the story of the past in your own mind to create a more truthful account that actually allows you to reclaim your own perceptions and what you know to be true. But that process of revisionist history, if you will, for most people, I think it never really stops. And for me, it never fully stopped. Even after I ultimately arrived, over the course of the Title IX investigation I went through, over the course of writing this book, over the course of talking about it many times with many different people, even after all of that, when I have this seemingly stable narrative of what happened, I can still catch myself falling into the old justifications that he advanced when they crossed my mind. Sometimes I still have dreams about this person. And in my dreams, they're never violent. It's always as it was at the beginning of our relationship, when it still seems so full of promise. And the me in the dream knows what's going to happen. So I have this constant sense of anxiety for, okay, when is it going to flip? But it never does. There's a part of you that still is sympathetic to this person. There's a part of you that is never really, I think, fully able to accept what happened if you are a survivor of abuse. So this revisionism, I think, can last over the course of a lifetime and take on many different shapes, depending on where you are. So I wouldn't fault myself, the person that I was when I was in this relationship, for various reasons, but I think I identify with them and their confusion, because that confusion has never fully left me, even to this day.
To me, it was almost like a couple things were going on. On the one hand, there was this kind of sense of idealism about the past. You said yourself, you're living kind of the relationship like follows the arc of the Russian Revolution, and you're both immersed in the past, and you had a lot of idealism about where, about what this could be. And then eventually it turns into something else, but you clinging to that, the hopes and desires of what it could be. And that's maybe the powerful foundation for denialism about the reality of, I don't know, maybe if you draw the go back and do this comparative thing with the Russian Revolution, maybe a lot of the other, the fellow travelers of Stalin were caught up in the same thing. So caught up in the idealism of where things could go that they had, weren't able to come to terms with Stalin's maneuvering and eventually elimination of his rivals.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And for what it's worth, this person and I, you know, shared the same progressive, leftist, I thought feminist political ideals, which I turned out once I got to know them on a much deeper level that the things that they said did not always match up with their behavior. But yes, I think a running theme in both the story of my abusive relationship and in this abusive relationship in the past that I look at with Stalin and Bukharin is how the most virtuous ideals of compassion, empathy, uplifting the downtrodden, you name it, can be weaponized to dominate, to coerce. And you have to be pretty savvy to grasp that dynamic in real time as it's happening. And if you learn how to recognize it, I think it helps you be more resistant the next time it happens, whether it's a dictatorial person in an interpersonal relationship or at the head of state.
It's interesting because I was listening to a podcast yesterday, and it was talking about how people deal with traumatic, anxiety-producing moments, and often the people who are successful in overcoming them find a way to get outside of themselves. And they could even talk to themselves as if there was somebody else giving themselves advice. And maybe what you're doing, the writing process, you're getting that distance, that perspective that you need, because you're just too much in your head. You're too much subject to the idealism, the indoctrination of the relationship, and you need that distance for critical reflection. And it can't happen until you start working through those memories, putting it down on paper.
Yes, I think that that's true. I think, I could say a little bit more about that. To return just for one more moment to Bukharin, there was a disillusioned leftist named Arthur Koestler who wrote a novel inspired by Bukharin's experience called Darkness at Noon, which I found very inspirational while writing this book. And the main character, who's loosely inspired by Bukharin, is waiting in this jail cell to be executed after he's gone through all these attempts to rationalize and justify what's happening to him, and is ultimately unsuccessful in altering his fate. And over the course of the novel, there's this phrase that's repeated that in the Communist Party, there's no I, only we. You know, it's a collective liberatory subject. So the feelings and the needs of the individual are ultimately unimportant. This is a bourgeois capitalist way of thinking to focus on the individual. And Rubashov, this character inspired by Bukharin, shortly before he's led away to be shot, he uses the prison code of tapping on walls to tap the word I on the wall of his cell. So in the very last moments of his life, he rediscovers his I, his individual subjectivity that does have some meaning. which he's only able to discover through the process of his own death. And for me, this became a very powerful symbol at one point of trying to reclaim my own subjectivity through this experience of what Czesław Miłosz called the captive mind, of chaining your consciousness to a bigger collective and kind of losing the value of the individual and the individual life. But as time passed, I also discovered that I was not enough. The person who abused me was completely immersed in his own subjectivity and was constantly trying to force his monologic soliloquy onto others. So after breaking from that individual, I didn't just want to be a person who was, you know, so immersed in my own narcissistic psyche, because I had seen where that can lead. So I wanted to rebuild some kind of collective subject, some kind of we to join. And I found that to some extent by connecting with other survivors of different types of abuse, researching them, writing about them, hearing from their experiences. But then, of course, you open up a bigger set of problems about the differences that, of course, nonetheless arise, even between people who have been through similar traumatic experiences and process them in sometimes quite different ways, depending on their background. So, yes, after I leave this relationship at the end of part one, some of what I do in the subsequent two parts is sort through where I find myself in these other collectives, past and present, of survivors that in some ways reflect or coalesce with my experience and in some ways challenge it or depart from it.
And what's fascinating is through the process of working through the memories of your own past, maybe creating, getting that critical distance to make sense of it, you gain this new perspective, almost like a third eye, where you can see things that you might have, that might have been trained out of you in the course of your programming. You might have not even wanted to look there, but you're able to spot and notice things of significance that you incorporate into your dissertation, into your book. And here I'm thinking of another comparative story that you tell of Oleg and Lisa. And this is something that maybe somebody else without that perspective might have missed or might have just dismissed. So how did this come to your attention? What parallels did you see with your own life? How did you notice this in a way that you might have missed had you not had your own experience?
When I was in Russia doing dissertation research, I spent a lot of time in Moscow looking at archives. And at first it felt like a tremendous relief, because at the same time as I was being so overexposed in the course of this Title IX investigation, with my personal correspondence being poured over, I was able to resume the safe, comfortable, voyeuristic position of the historian who is judging other people who can't really talk back because they're usually dead, and reading their letters to form opinions about them and what happened in the past. So as I was doing this, one of the people I was looking into for my dissertation was an actor named Oleg Dahl, who was a star of Soviet stage and screen in the 1970s. And he came to prominence for depicting various misanthropic men, basically. And he was a quite self-destructive person in his own life. And as I was at the Russian State Library, leafing through some books about him, I came across just sort of a casual aside from his mother-in-law, who, in a set of written recollections about him, said that Oleg was such a great, interesting guy, but he turned into an animal when he was drunk, and On one occasion, he, quote unquote, lightly strangled his wife, which was the daughter, who was the daughter of the person writing this. And I sat up in my chair when I came across this, because only a few months ago, I had been, quote unquote, lightly strangled by a man I had been in a relationship with. And I was suddenly shaken out of this position of comfort and distance in relation to the past. And once again, interlacing it with my own recent memories in the present. So I went on a big archival detour, which I told myself was necessary for my dissertation, to find out basically what I thought happened between Lisa and Oleg. And I went to an archive in Moscow that holds hundreds of their letters that they exchanged. And the kinds of language that Lisa used in her letters to her mother and to him reminded me so much of my former self. She was always very eager to assert that things were good now, things were better, he was about to change, he was sober. But there was this very strained tone a lot of the time to what she was saying. And sometimes these euphemisms, like on one occasion, she wasn't able to maintain this veneer of normalcy and said, it was bad, fear, etc. And again, I was sort of stunned by my own identification with this person because I knew what etc. meant. All of these things that she didn't want to admit, couldn't express, I had been through them too. And I had used euphemisms just like she had when I was talking to my friends or my own mother. There's another strange dimension of being a historian where, on the one hand, everything that you write is supposed to be empirically rooted in written, usually written sources. You cannot go beyond what has been recorded in the archive. And at the same time, you are very aware of the limitations of archives. They are created by people, institutions of power with specific purposes in mind. And scholars in recent decades have come up with various creative approaches to try to make silence speak and fill out the perspectives of people whose voices are muffled or entirely absent in archival documents. The scholar probably best known for doing this is named Sadia Hartman, who studied the lives of enslaved women, who usually only their name would be mentioned in a slave ledger perhaps, or in some kind of text, where they really were allowed to have no subjectivity and never speak for themselves. So when I was looking at these letters written by Lisa, it was quite different from the kinds of sources that Hartman was using. You know, this was a very educated, literate woman in the 1970s in the Soviet Union who left behind a large amount of written material. And yet she censored herself in keeping with the cultural, social expectations of her time and the psychological needs that she had in this dangerous situation. So I found myself pulling from this, I guess in hindsight you could call it a feminist epistemology or something like that, but what it felt was just the embodied memory of what this all had been like for me as I lived through it, to understand and imagine what Lisa had been through, even though she didn't say it directly in these sources. And something interesting I discovered while I was writing this book is that I was certain I had mentioned the fact that Oleg had been violent to Lisa in my dissertation, because I saw how, if you really think about it, his abuse of his wife fit into his bigger cultural image, which was very popular, of this misanthropic man who was constantly performing his torments, and how that kind of public image actually relied on hidden female emotional labor to keep going as a performance. So I had created this kind of, I thought, intellectual way of slipping it in to my PhD thesis. But when I went back and looked at it while writing this book, I was surprised to find that Lisa's name did not appear. There was no mention of all of this archival research that I had done and thinking that I had done to try to understand what happened to her. And I felt kind of confused and ashamed that I had written out this story that I had gone to such lengths to uncover. But in thinking about it, I realized it made sense. I don't remember exactly why I didn't put it in, but I imagine that it felt too closely connected with this messy personal experience that I was trying so desperately to hide from most of my fellow students and professors, to present myself as, you know, a neutral, objective, informed historian who was writing a scholarly work. It must have felt too uncomfortable to have touched on something that related to my own embodied experience. So I simply deleted it. And I was grateful for the opportunity in this book to really revisit Lisa's story and be able to write about it in a fuller way, drawing on the first person that attempts to actually recover and reclaim this account, which maybe is not of great interest to the average historian of the Soviet Union, but was of tremendous interest to me, and I think very telling in some ways about that time.
So I think what's interesting here, and there's a lot going on with Lisa and Oleg, on the one hand, she basically takes the complete journey that you could have gone down. She loses herself entirely in her partner's life, and she disappears into his world. Even after he's gone, she's still writing his story until her dying days, and disappearing in the process. And I think a lot of what you're revealing is how these stories of abuse get buried and forgotten, and that, you know, women, you could argue, are complicit in the process of their own forgetting. And maybe, you know, for all kinds of different reasons, maybe the societal norms you mentioned, or the hopes and aspirations that she had, or maybe she's just entrapped in that vision that is her, for whatever reasons, she can't break free of that. And at the other, on the other hand, you are struggling with, well, how do you incorporate this into your dissertation? Because you're not supposed to be including, you know, you're not supposed to be projecting, you're not supposed to be guessing. If you can't substantiate this, so it's the messiness of your own life that's uncomfortable, but also it's the, what's the committee going to say? Is the committee going to approve of this? And you edit that out, and what you reveal in the course of your book is the hypocrisy there, that when you get to read the evidence of your own case, and you have these professors that you hold in high esteem who pretend like they're objective and only relying on the evidence, that's never the case, that their own life experiences, their own subjectivities always enter into how they see the present and the past.
Yes, I could not agree more. And going through this Title IX case and seeing the different things that historians I admired said, really, it was not simply disillusioning, but completely changed the way that I think about history and doing history and the position of the expert. I was trained in a tradition that was really anchored in the 19th century and the work of German historians who wanted to bring history closer to the social sciences by doing archival research, looking at the documents, and trying to capture what quote unquote really happened in the past. And this created a style of writing that was always in the third person. Again, as you said, the ideal is not to project, to be like an archaeologist brushing away the dust on the dinosaur bone and uncovering what's already perfectly formed and already there. But I learned over the course of my PhD that since the 1980s, there had been various theorists who challenged the obvious hypocrisies and flaws in this approach and maintained that historians were actually projecting a whole lot more than they claimed to be. And the most prominent person who challenged the historical establishment and this way of doing history in the distant third person was named Hayden White. And he pioneered what you might call the Rashomon approach to history, where really there is no truth. There are only different narratives. One is not any more accurate or objective than the other. The truth is in the eye of the beholder. And when I came across Hayden White's writings in a philosophy of history class, I found them interesting, but they were so far from what I was learning to do as a PhD student. But then I thought of them again when, if you're a complainant in a 1009 case, one of the trials that you endure is having to read hundreds, sometimes thousands of pages of evidence, letters, interviews with professors and students in your department about what they think happened to you. And lo and behold, these people who were very sophisticated in making assessments about the past found themselves, I think, repeating narratives that they had heard, that they wanted to find compelling, without really any knowledge of what happened. And it's like, you know, in Hayden White's terms, one of the ways of writing historical narrative is in the mode of comedy. So there's something bad that happens, but then it ends with this reintegration, you know, happily ever after, basically. And that's the narrative about the past that I had wanted to believe when I was in the relationship, that everything would get better, it would all be okay, and that I had to part with once I left. But I found that narrative lived on around a lot of people in our community. Some of them were very quick to assert that this guy had been suffering a mental breakdown and that his actions had nothing to do with, you know, abuse or anything like that. He was simply a victim who was suffering, basically, and needed more help, more support. And, you know, some of them, one person in particular, really went out of their way to even insert kind of new details that supported this narrative about how this person was supposedly pursued by a lynch mob. I quote, a lynch mob of people going after him, when the reality had been the complete opposite.
And that person wasn't even there, if I recall, right?
That person was not on campus or in Berkeley or in America even at the time. And the reality was the total opposite. My ex-boyfriend was extremely talented in his manipulations and had gone out of his way to curry a lot of favor and sympathy among graduate students and professors. So it was absolutely empirically false that he was being martyred in any way. But the power of this story was so appealing, so comfortable to think that, well, this is just this guy who's going through a bad, hard time. And if we don't do anything, if we just, you know, help him even more, then everything will be fine. It was so easy to fall into it with no curiosity about or knowledge of what I had been through, which, of course, I was not aggressively publicly broadcasting. So it seemed to me that once I moved on from the Title IX case, I started applying these insights from postmodernism to the practice of doing history in general, and to think a lot more about how the cultural, social, national environments in which we're raised permeate our narratives about the past in a way that we might not be fully conscious of when we're writing, but that we could be much more self-aware and reflective about if we were, for example, more willing to engage in the risky work of using the first person who is upfront about their background, their biases. And once you start doing that, it's a lot less safe. You have to really challenge some of your presumptions and justify things that otherwise might have gone unstated. So this is kind of an approach that I have landed on going forward as a way of trying to counter this blindness that we often have in relation to the past and unawareness about our own preconceptions concerning it.
Now, you've mentioned Title IX a number of times. We really haven't gone into detail on that, but that is a big, big part of your book. And you have another comparative story where you talk about the case of Tanya Tarasoff at Berkeley, and you're using that to think about yourself and the rights that women have achieved since the 1960s, and Title IX is part of that story, and how she didn't benefit from that, and how her story might have been very different if it had happened several decades later. Could you talk about her and then what you learned about Title IX and how it grew over time and how it wasn't necessarily that well received even at Berkeley?
To start with Tanya Tarasoff, a friend of a friend told me a little bit about what happened to her right after I fled Berkeley in a panic to escape my boyfriend, who I was terrified would kill me. And she told me this story as a way of encouraging me to keep taking precautions and have as many safeguards as I could before I even thought about going back to Berkeley. The short version of what happened to Tanya is that she was a student at Berkeley in 1968, 1969, and she went on a few dates with a graduate student from India who was also studying at the university. She thought it was a very casual relationship. She wasn't that interested. And after these few dates, she, you know, wanted to move on and see other guys. He didn't agree. His name was Prasenjit Poddar, and he began stalking her around Berkeley's campus and ultimately very violently murdered her. He had actually told his therapist at Berkeley, among other people, that he was planning to do this, but nobody warned her in time. So she did not understand the threat that she was under or have any tools that would have helped her cope with the situation and get away. So there was a legal case. Her parents, her family, they were Russian immigrants, actually. They ended up suing the university, and the case established a legal precedent about the duty to warn that might be familiar to people who have studied law or psychology, that in some states, therapists have a duty to warn their patients if they think there's a credible, their duty to warn an individual against whom their patient presents a credible threat of violence. But even so, even though a fair amount of legal and psychological ink had been spilled over this case, in researching it, when I went back to it for the book, it struck me that no one had ever really viewed it within the frame of gender-based violence, which is what it was. So that's the approach that I took when I went back to Berkeley to do more research on it while working on this book. And I wanted to understand basically why I, a person who was in a very similar situation, survived and she didn't, at the same university, separated only by a handful of decades. And what I discovered was that she did not have access to basically any of the resources that helped me both understand my situation and also help keep me safe. In 1969, when she died, there were no restraining orders. There were not any laws against domestic violence or stalking. And of course, there was no Title IX. Shortly before she died, Tanya called an administrator at Berkeley and told them that she was scared about this student who was stalking her. But there was no procedure in place to deal with the situation. And the administrator basically said, "I'm busy right now. You can come see me, you know, in X number of days." And by that point, Tanya was already dead. Even if she had survived and had been able to show up for that appointment, there was no plan. Anything they might have done to help handle the situation would have been entirely at the discretion of this one administrator. And because of this communal tendency to deny and cover up and disbelieve victims, which I discovered in my own case, you know, I seriously doubt that she would have received much help from this particular individual who would have been handling it informally. So, Title IX. Actually, in the same year that Tanya died, there was a woman who earned a PhD at the University of Maryland named Bernice Sandler. And she was denied a job when she finished her PhD on the grounds that she, quote unquote, came on too strong for a woman. So Bernice banded together with activists working with Women's Equity Action League to gather complaints from various universities and take this to the federal government and say, this is unfair. You know, you can't deny someone employment on the basis of sex. And the complaint that they made culminated in what we call Title IX, which was part of the Educational Amendments of 1972. Which prohibited federal funding to any institution that discriminates on the basis of sex. And in the early years after Title IX's implementation, it was mainly applied to employment and athletics. But the people who had gotten Title IX passed were older feminists who believed in working within institutions to try to increase women's representation within them. Over the course of the 1970s, this new generation of feminists comes up, the second wave, radical feminists, as they were then frequently known, who start arguing that these institutions that feminists had trusted were themselves rotten, and that women needed to have a much more direct approach in bringing them down. And one of the major issues that they came to focus on was sexual and domestic violence. A group of feminists involved in a lawsuit at Cornell in the late 1970s coined the term sexual harassment, which had not existed up until that time. So these feminists, who are very focused on sexual and domestic violence as tools of the patriarchy, which they're trying to bring down, take up Title IX as a tool in their struggle and start fighting to apply it to violence at schools, sexual, domestic abuse, harassment, all of these things. And this ends up happening at Berkeley as well. Basically, to no effect, the feminists are pretty unsuccessful in getting the administration to take them seriously. And one of the interesting documents that I uncovered when I went back to Berkeley and did some archival research on the history of my own institution is that in 1976, universities all across the country had to submit reports to the federal government saying what they were doing to comply with Title IX. So there were reports that University of California at Berkeley gathered from every department assessing what they thought was happening with sex discrimination in their communities. And as I read these reports, I was astounded to find that they all said basically the same thing. There is no problem. There is no sex discrimination. There is no abuse. To return to what we were just saying earlier about silences in the archive, I mean, it's hard to think of a bigger silence than this, especially since, I should add, many of these departments, they employed zero women, or maybe they would have one woman faculty member. So, you know, they simply, these men were not equipped to perceive the problem of discrimination. It was so invisible to them. It was so steeped into their thinking that they couldn't see it. And even the history department, I read the report that they submitted, and they said, the department chair said something to the effect that our focus on scholarship precludes us from any thought about sex. Which, you know, if you
it's like a monastic statement. It's almost like a monastic statement.
Yeah. And this is the ideal, the completely unrealistic ideal that was being upheld.
So even this progressive institution is forgetting or in complete denial about its own discriminatory past and a history of abuse under its own roof. And the women, you would think some tenured faculty members of women might speak out, but the weight of the institution is too much for them to go up against.
Yeah, you know, there were so few women faculty members at that time, and they were under tremendous pressure to basically integrate themselves into the old boys club. And one of the ways that I found out, yeah, they supported this narrative, which they knew to be wrong, but they couldn't afford to challenge if they wanted to keep their jobs. One of the ways that I uncovered what was actually happening at Berkeley in the 1970s was by reading the records of an oral history project that were done only a few years ago with a bunch of people who had been faculty at that time. And many years later, several of these people described, in particular, there was one professor in the history department who was a serial sexual assaulter, harasser, possibly even rapist, statutory rape at a minimum. Everyone knew this. Everyone covered up for him. So clearly these problems were rampant, but institutions were very slow and very reluctant to deal with them, despite the best efforts of these tiny numbers of second wave feminists who were trying to protest and apply pressure. And it really wasn't until a new generation took up this problem in the 2010s, when I was earning my PhD, actually, that institutions finally, under the threat of serious lawsuits, started to develop more policies and procedures for dealing with gender-based abuse on their campuses. And as a person who has been through the gauntlet of that system, I have seen how incredibly difficult it can be and how extremely rare it is to get any kind of quote-unquote justice, to be taken seriously, to have an investigation, to have that investigation result in any kind of finding, to have the person face any kind of consequence. It's extremely unusual. And institutions actually produce reports about the cases they handle each year, so you can look into this. Even though these tools are still so underutilized or misused by institutions to suppress cases rather than really looking into them, I still defend this system because these bureaucrats who actually took their jobs very seriously, they spent years researching my case and produced a several hundred page report based on a lot of empirical evidence in a way that I think was more sophisticated sometimes than what historians do. They were the only people who really wanted to hear about what happened to me, while the direct members of my community were more interested in sweeping it under the rug for various reasons. These people within a system that had been set up for this purpose came in and took it out of their hands, took it out of all of our hands, and actually looked into it, and in the end actually did something. And I have to tell you, as a survivor of abuse, to receive any validation from an institution is priceless. After all of the mental gymnastics and schizophrenia and doubt that you have put yourself through, that the abuser has put you through, that your community has put you through, to have even the hope of being recognized, supported, helped is invaluable. So as flawed as the system is, I think that its existence at least raises the possibility that something like what happened to Tanya might not happen to another person. And it didn't happen to me.
And I think it's important to spotlight here. And I had to go back and look at your book again, too. It's like, well, why didn't she take this to court? Why didn't she have other avenues she could have gone down? Because she wins her case within the university. But well, what happens to the perpetrator? He's expelled. He's not really, there's no punishment beyond that. He can't continue that trajectory he was on. But you point out that there really isn't any other avenue, that the burden of evidence is so much higher, and these cases are so particular, they happen behind closed doors, that evidence that where you have the victim that's often participating and covering up the story, they're really hard cases to make. So the opportunity to be able to make them within the context of Title IX, within the university framework, gives you a better shot at justice.
It does. And of course, the vast majority of rape and domestic violence and sexual abuse cases are never reported to the police, and only a tiny fraction of those that are reported end up in any kind of conviction. So yeah, this local civil alternative provides at least some other meaningful option for people as they're trying to stay safe and stay away from this person who hurt them. And I actually did try going to the police, but the DA turned down my case because they said there wasn't enough evidence. Because, you know, with a jury trial, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. Prosecutors want cold, hard proof. And as you say, with these cases where most things happen behind closed doors, it's much more about interpreting who told whom when, you know, relying on words in many cases to build a picture of what happened, even if you don't have, you know, photographs of bruises, let's say, which is common. Many acts of violence don't leave bruises, including strangulation oftentimes, which is one of the most dangerous forms of domestic abuse. So yeah, it offers some avenue, some hope, something that people can do. And I think, unfortunately, people across the entire political spectrum, from self-identified leftist feminists like myself to avowed men's rights supporters, have turned against Title IX and this whole system. It's often, criticism of Title IX is often based on a narrative that it's all flimsy accusations by untrustworthy, naive, hysterical young women that are ruining the lives of innocent boys and men. And people make this argument from different motivations. People who are on the left-wing feminist side incorporate it sometimes in a broader critique of the criminal justice system and the phenomenon of mass incarceration. But I think that this discourse can get so messy and so far from any kind of data or reality. To point out one obvious fact, being suspended from school or even dismissed from school as a PhD student is not the same as being incarcerated for years. I mean, these are totally different scales.
You have no criminal record, right?
Yes. There's no trace of what you have done in the broader world. You can be employed somewhere the next day and no one will ever know. So yeah,
that's the frightening part. Hey, so yeah. To me, that's what I thought was interesting. You finish your book. There's this disconnect. On the one hand, you said there's this perception that women are taking advantage of the system, that they're too empowered the way Title IX stands as it is. And I'm hoping you'll comment on some of the changes that happened, while you were going through this, some of those changes that are being reenacted now. How this is completely at odds with the reality of the opportunities or the resources for recourse that women actually have, or even when they do seek the recourse, what actually happens?
Yeah, absolutely. When I first filed my complaint, it was summer 2017, and it was just before the Me Too movement kicked off, which was, you know, I found very inspiring and validating in the sense that I felt like I wasn't alone. I was doing the right thing and coming forward. I was part of this movement that was bigger than myself. But of course, what Me Too was reacting to was the election of Donald Trump, who, you know, is a known, has been found guilty in civil court of rape, and has faced really no meaningful consequences for his long pattern of open misconduct. And the person that he appointed to head the Department of Education, Betsy DeVos, during his first administration, was openly in the pocket of men's rights groups who wanted to gut Title IX on the basis of this narrative that, you know, oh, these poor young men are being attacked by this hysterical mob of young women. And over the course of Trump's first term in office, men's rights groups actually drafted the changes that made it in to the official policy for what Title IX became under Trump. To make a long story short, they made it much harder for victims or survivors to come forward. And they directly impacted the procedures, actually, in my case. For example, one of the things that they implemented was making live cross-examination of the victim mandatory. So there has to be a hearing where the person accused of abuse has the opportunity to publicly, directly question the person that they abused, which, as I'm sure you can imagine, is very intimidating for people who have been.
They're not actually sitting across a table, though. It's not like they're sitting across a table from you.
It depends. They can be. I was given the opportunity to do it remotely, so I was on Zoom. But nevertheless, it's an extremely uncomfortable, confrontational experience that most people would not want to go through and would further discourage them from coming forward and filing a case. There's all kinds of other stuff they did, like freeing universities from any obligation to look into incidents that occur off campus. So collectively, they just contributed to making Title IX even harder than it already was to enforce. The Biden administration, just before Biden left office, finally completed its overhaul of the Title IX system to try to undo or restore various changes that Trump had made. For example, one of the other things that Trump's administration did was to raise the bar of evidence to bring it closer to the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, which is much higher than what's required in civil court, where preponderance of evidence, which had previously been the standard, is the norm. So Biden's administration restored the previous bar for evidence and did some stuff that sounds good, but I think it's worth noting that in the face of public pressure from all of these voices across the spectrum and in fear of litigation, universities like Berkeley had already preemptively introduced all of these procedures, like mandatory live cross-examination, even before Trump's administration had made them official. So basically, Trump's education department established a precedent of raising the bar higher and higher that universities are now very reluctant to step back from, in fear that they will be sued by people who face complaints. And of course, now that Trump has been reelected, I'm sure that Title IX will, you know, be decimated once again. Although, of course, his education department is in huge disarray in general. So I don't think that, you know, the niceties of the regulations are their top priority at the moment. But the upshot of all of this is that Title IX investigations will remain extremely rare, too long, too difficult to maintain, and most survivors of gender-based violence on campuses will continue not to get help.
Joy, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Joy Neumeyer is an historian of Russia and a journalist based in Warsaw, Poland. She's the author of A Survivor's Education, Women, Violence, and the Stories We Don't Tell. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. The best endorsement is word of mouth. I'm Rick Derdarian. Thanks for listening.